For Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Japan and Saudi Arabia are the big spenders at a donors conference to rebuild Iraq. Nary a euro from France or Germany.
Also, how Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is angering his party's elite.
Madam Chiang Kai-shek remembering one of the first media superstars. Her 105 years span the history of modern China.
And Vietnam dealing with opening the doors to the U.S.
Like we say, we open door. A lot of fresh air come in, and also dust. How to keep the dust away and let the fresh air in?
These stories and films inspired by Columbine coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. U.S. military officials say three soldiers were killed today in two separate attacks in Iraq. Two soldiers were killed by insurgents in a mortar attack on an American base north of Baghdad near the city of Samarra. Earlier, one soldier was killed in a shootout in Mosul. There was also an attack on U.S. forces in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. NPR's Jackie Leiden has more.
Fallujah had been relatively quiet until last weekend when an American ammunition truck was hit by a grenade. It sent volley of explosions into the air and dozens of young Iraqi men danced in the streets. There have been attempts to improve relations between the people of Fallujah and the U.S. military of late, but this week not a day has passed quietly. A soldier from the 82nd Airborne was killed there Monday, another was wounded by a homemade bomb Thursday, and in an incident Friday, three soldiers were evacuated after an accident in which they sprayed gunfire into the air. One soldier was attacked and beaten and later rescued. These reports of violence come as the International Donors Conference concludes in Madrid. The violence raises fears of diminishing investment in Iraq. Jackie Leiden, NPR News, Baghdad.
The five permanent members of the UN Security Council have opened discussions on draft resolution designed to help limit terrorists' access to weapons of mass destruction. Linda Vasulo reports from New York.
Diplomats from the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China met for the first time yesterday to discuss a draft Russian proposal as well as U.S. ideas for such a measure. The veto-wielding nations are concerned about terrorists getting their hands on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. In September, President Bush, French President Jacques Chirac, and U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan concurred that unconventional weapons needed to be carefully controlled. President Bush has stressed that he would prefer a new resolution that would urge all nations to criminalize the proliferation of such weapons and impose strict export controls. A Russian draft calls on countries to report compliance to the UN, but the U.S. seems to favor creating a monitoring group. Further discussions are expected. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
The Concorde made its last journey from New York to London today. It flew into Heathrow Airport late this morning. Supermodel Christie Brinkley was one of the passengers on today's flight.
I was on one of the first Concordes when, you know, back in the days when they'd pass out the cigars, and it was all, like, very exciting and, like, a return to elegance. And I feel like we're really losing something with this.
It landed minutes after two other British Airways Concordes touched down. Every seat was filled. The supersonic jet proved too loud and too expensive to stay in business. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 80 points to 95.33 in moderate trading of 587 million shares. The Nasdaq is down 30 points to 18.54. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the on-again, off-again merger talks between AT&T and Bell South may be on again. From member station WFUV in New York, George Bodarki reports.
A report in the Wall Street Journal cites people familiar with the situation as saying talks between AT&T and Bell South have resumed 2 months after they broke down. The newspaper says executives of the two phone companies discussed a possible union this week. Under any agreement, Atlanta-based Bell South would buy the nation's largest long-distance carrier, but the merged entity would take the AT&T brand name. AT&T's market capitalization is about $15 billion, while Bell South's market cap is nearly $48 billion. The journal says merger talks surfaced again because AT&T's rival MCI is rapidly emerging from bankruptcy protection, and that threatens to increase competition in AT&T's core business. For NPR News, I'm George Bodarki in New York.
Law enforcement officials today say new evidence indicates Walmart executives knew they had illegal immigrants working on cleaning crews at its stores around the country. Federal agents raided Walmart's headquarters and 60 Walmart stores around the nation yesterday. More than 300 illegal immigrants were arrested. A published report today says Putnam Investments is replacing four of its money managers who allegedly engaged in market timing trades of mutual funds to benefit their personal accounts 3 years ago. The Wall Street Journal says the action comes a day after Smith Barney fired four additional brokers for the same infraction. Smith Barney fired its first round of brokers for improper trading of mutual funds less than a month ago. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Pledges to help rebuild Iraq are coming in a trickle, not the torrent the United States hoped for at the Donors Conference in Madrid, which ends today. About $19 billion has been raised in grants and loans. That's about $36 billion short of the amount the World Bank estimates Iraq will need over the next 4 years. Joining us from Madrid is reporter Paolo Prada, who's covering the conference for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Paolo.
Hi, how you doing?
Paolo, any surprises at the conference so far?
Nothing really huge has come up that has caught anyone off guard. The Iraqis and everyone suspects the coalition government pretty much knew what was in order. What people are satisfied about, though, is that the small figures are all starting to add up, and when you put them on top of what was already pledged by countries in the past couple of weeks. It's a fairly sizable amount that's going to help the country address its short-term needs, and that's really the important part right now.
Part of the reason for the shortfall, of course, France and Germany didn't pony up anything, right?
Well, they have only put in what is going to be donated through the European Union. It, as a bloc, has already committed funds, and the French and the Germans have said they're going to hold out until they see how the governing situation progresses in Iraq. And they really want to see a more stable environment, more security, but most of all, a sovereign and independent Iraqi government before they commit to giving a lot more money.
The European Union, Paolo, will actually be giving less money to rebuilding Iraq than it pledged for rebuilding much smaller Afghanistan, right?
Right, so far. But the EU's been very clear in what it's saying. It says, this is the money we're going to give now. We're going to wait, and in the medium term, which really for them means next year, we'll continue to assess the situation and donate more money further down the road.
Yeah. How about the Arab world?
The Arab world is actually doing a fair amount. Some of the Iraq's rich neighbors who care a lot about stability in the region today announced some fairly sizable grants. The Saudis said they would give $1 billion, but that's over the period of 4 years, the next 4 years through 2007. And half of that, at least, is going to be take the form of loans. So it's still good, but that means only half of the money will be coming in the short term. Also, Kuwait has said it would donate a similar amount. But a lot of the questions here are about how soon some of the money is going to be coming and how much of it's going to be put off for the longer term in credits and foreign investment and that kind of thing.
Paolo, just to finish up, what's the mood at the conference? Is there tension? Is the United States reasonably content?
Well, I think that there is a little relief just from seeing that some of the money is starting to trickle in. I wouldn't say there's a whole lot of tension because the French, the Germans, the Russians made their position clear well ahead of this conference. And I think people are, you know, somewhat pleased that they're at least here listening to what the Iraqis and the governing coalition, the U.S.-led effort itself, has to say. So, you know, progress is small and limited, but it's still progress.
Yeah. Paolo Prada covering the Madrid Donors Conference. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Paolo Prada is covering the conference for the Boston Globe.
Republican members of Congress are telling reporters they are losing patience with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. A report in today's New York Times says Rumsfeld and top aides such as Paul Wolfowitz have ignored or refused key Republican leaders' requests for information on defense matters. One top Republican official is quoted as saying Rumsfeld has become a millstone around the president's neck. Joining us from Washington is Douglas Gell. He co-wrote the story in today's Times. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Well, we know of some of the recent sort of battles between Rumsfeld and members of the administration, let's say Condoleezza Rice, for one. And then there was the War on Terror memo, his, that was leaked earlier this week. And now apparently a letter from Senator John Warner of Virginia. Tell us about that.
Well, it sounds that Mr. Rumsfeld made a very elementary error in Washington. He ignored or forgot to respond to a request from members of Congress, and that never makes anyone on Capitol Hill happy.
And the request was what?
The request was that Mr. Rumsfeld take action against General Boykin. This is the Pentagon general whose comments linking the war on terrorism to religion caused so much stir around the country last week.
And as you write, Senator Warner made his letter public after not hearing anything from Mr. Rumsfeld. And Mr. Rumsfeld said he's not aware of the letter. It might be in the building somewhere.
That's right. And while it may sound like a petty matter, it's more significant than this. The concern on Capitol Hill for a long time has been that Mr. Rumsfeld has been treating members of Congress in a high-handed, perhaps even arrogant manner. And in this episode, in which a request that Mr. Rumsfeld addressed this issue regarding Mr. Boykin quickly somehow slipped through the cracks, really is seen by someone, including Republicans on Capitol Hill, as almost a last straw.
But, well, is it really? And can you distinguish further for us between this incident and, as you said, the others that we've been hearing about? I mean, what does make this different and what might happen?
I think this is different mostly as a capstone. The frustration on Capitol Hill with Mr. Rumsfeld has been building for a long time. What might happen? Difficult to say, of course. No one in the White House seems to want Mr. Rumsfeld to resign, but even within the White House, there's a sense of frustration and a feeling that perhaps his political radar isn't as attuned as it should be to the way these comments are perceived in Washington and around the country.
Is there any sense, though, that the administration and the White House might be involved in some of these leaks to papers such as yours? Or is it just the people who are known to be not friendly towards Donald Rumsfeld? I'm thinking of some of the Pentagon generals and, again, some of the people on Capitol Hill.
Well, the article this morning quotes Republicans close to the White House speaking quite critically of Mr. Rumsfeld. Clearly, there's an attempt, not just by Republicans on the Hill, but within the administration to get the word to Mr. Rumsfeld that perhaps a change in his manner or approach might be a good idea.
And one last question before we let you go. When you say last straw, do you have a sense of any timing, any sense that Mr. Rumsfeld might be leaving his post?
I don't. And perhaps last straw would be going too far. But clearly, even top Republicans in Congress are so fed up with Mr. Rumsfeld that they have begun to speak out to reporters like me and through their aides to say we've had it and something needs to change. Mm. I think it's just going to be difficult to predict what happens from here on.
Douglas Gell, thank you.
Thank you.
Douglas Gell, correspondent for The New York Times.
A chapter in modern Chinese history closed as Madame Chiang Kai-shek, the widow of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, passed away at 11:17 p.m. Thursday, Taipei time.
That's Radio Taiwan announcing the death of Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who died yesterday in New York at 105. Her life spanned the epic history of China in the 20th century. When she married General Chiang Kai-shek, she also married into his nationalist cause and was eventually forced out of China with him by Mao Zedong's communists in 1948. She would never return. We're joined now by Professor William Joseph, a specialist in Asian studies at Wellesley College, Madam Chiang Kai-shek's alma mater in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Welcome, Professor.
Glad to be with you.
Now, Professor, Madam Chiang Kai-shek was a daughter of a very traditional China, was she not? She was a member of one of the country's most prominent families.
She was. Her family was certainly traditional in many ways, but it was also quite modern and quite Western in others. Her father was an early convert to Christianity. He had been educated in the United States. He educated his daughters as well as his sons.
She went to Wellesley, graduated in 1917, majored in English literature, described by her classmates in something I read as chubby, vivacious, and determined. And then she met her husband in 1922. Who was Chiang Kai-shek, and how did they come to marry? Was it a love match?
Not really. It was a match by that time of one of China's wealthiest families with the man who was on the rise to become China's most powerful leader. It was during a time of great chaos, and Chiang Kai-shek was soon to succeed Sun Yat-sen as the leader of the Chinese nationalist movement.
Turbulent time. They were married in Shanghai, a city dense with gangsters and criminality then.
Mm-hmm. They married in 1927, and Shanghai was the seat of Chiang Kai-shek's power. He was consolidating his power at that time against the communists, and he consolidated his power by not only using brute force, but also by striking deals with warlords and the equivalent of the Chinese mafia or gang leaders in Shanghai.
Professor, now, what kind of a woman was Sung Mai Ling, which is, of course, her maiden name? Was she someone who always hungered for power, or because of the man she married, she found herself thrown into power?
I think she depicted herself as a scholar, a lover of books, and and always spoke fondly of her years at Wellesley. And she actually entered Wellesley when she was quite young, 15 or 16, I believe. But she quickly proved very astute at being the wife of China's most powerful leader, and became very much a political partner with him throughout the years of civil war and world war in China.
What was her relationship with the United States, particularly during World War II?
Well, she became China's voice. She spoke English beautifully, and she really became, I'd say, the face of China, and I think America's hope for China.
She barnstormed the country, speaking on behalf of the nationalist cause, right?
She did, and raised millions of dollars in war aid. She gave a memorable address at Joint Session of Congress in 1943. She spoke at the Hollywood Bowl, surrounded by movie stars. She was quite glamorous and very effective.
Yet General Joseph Stilwell in China and many others in power in the United States, including no less a personage than Eleanor Roosevelt, came to have a certain degree of contempt for her, right?
Yes, they did. I think people who met her found her quite imperious or imperial. But her image, particularly promoted by Henry Luce, who was the publisher of Time magazine, she and her husband appeared on the cover of Time several times during the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Just to finish up then, Professor, what was Madam Chiang Kai-shek's image? We've talked a bit about her image in the United States, but what about in Taiwan, the country, of course, her husband led for so long?
You know, in retrospect, she's remembered very fondly. I know that when I travel to Taiwan, and people know that I teach at Wellesley College, it brings nothing but warm words about Madam Chiang. Generally, I think she's remembered fondly and warmly as a person who contributed a lot to Chinese history, controversial at times, but nevertheless is someone that they're proud of as a representative of their country.
Professor William Joseph, a political scientist at Wellesley College, speaking to us about Madam Chiang Kai-shek. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Just ahead, a view from Vietnam, the delicate balance between communism and a thriving capitalist spirit.
And later in the program, two fierce and fascinating new films inspired by Columbine.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There's news that Vietnam will soon send the first high-ranking official to Washington since the war, and that the U.S. and Vietnam have reinstituted direct flights between the countries, all of which reminds me of Kong.
The big building over there, that is the Hanoi Tower, with the nickname Hanoi Hilton.
Kong was my guide 2 years ago on a trip through Vietnam. He took us through Hanoi, Hue, and Saigon. We took Kong kayaking on Ha Long Bay. With the U.S. and Vietnam strengthening relations, I thought it would be interesting to hear Kong's thoughts as his communist country embraced a new capitalistic Western openness. I asked him what he thought of the new thinking. In Vietnam, they call it Doi Mui.
Doi Mui. Like we say, we open door. A lot of fresh air come in. And also dust. How to keep the dust away and let the fresh air in.
What do you see as the dust?
The dust is the like materialism, drugs problem, prostitution, and the influence from the West. Just like my daughter. She liked to watch MTV. I say, why noisy and dancing? Look at this, like this, like this, like a snake moving. But see, how to keep the traditional and how to get the new. How to catch up the neighbor country. Because we had 15 years during the war, and then 15 more years closed the door. We are 3 decades behind.
Is advertising one of the social evils that the government's concerned about?
Yeah. The social evil, we call it decadence culture.
Even on the paperwork that we had to fill out to come into the country, on the back when it says what's prohibited to bring in, it lists some of those things, pornography, but also toys. It lists toys.
Yeah, because a lot of toys like a weapon. You notice in Vietnam, no weapon.
Why is that?
So why you have a weapon? I ask back.
Well, I don't have a weapon, but no. You mean in our country?
Yeah. Why in the West you have a weapon?
Well, people feel they have the right to have it.
Yeah, so we don't need it. You can stop the violence, crime here, safe.
Is it a reaction to the war, too? So much war?
Maybe. It is the reason we have enough. So you like what you don't have. Just like when we see the tourists riding bicycle in Vietnam or go to Vietnam for camping, we are surprised. We think you are crazy, because in our country, generation after generation living in the jungle, we have camping enough. So now we need an air conditioner room. And I dream of a car.
Yeah. What else do you think is crazy about Americans? I mean, what do you shake your head over?
On the time you want to talk about democracy, about human rights, you want to have a American mold, and you want to put me in the mold to see if it's fit or not. Funny thing to me.
Do you feel that people are criticizing you about human rights issues?
Yes. And I've heard one nice idea. You talk about human rights, our culture. We talk about human duties. Because a human right means individualist, human duty, more socialist, mainly to the family and to the village. The idea of the state not so strong in Vietnam.
So what are your hopes for your country?
I hope for my country to become dragon someday and keep our national identity and use American stuff. But not become American, just like a tiger. Eat the rabbit to keep the skin of the tiger, not become the rabbit.
What are the good things? What's the fresh air?
Fresh air means the new idea, economic management.
But Kong, you told me you don't even put your money in a bank.
I don't trust the bank. I give money to my wife. And she buy gold rings to keep in the house. It costs about $33. You ask my wife how much a TV, her answer is 8 gold rings. It's the traditional custom, and another reason we have a lot of wars. My father, he put all money in the bank overnight. The war finished. American went home. South Vietnam regime collapsed. All his money overnight become papers. I never forget that lesson.
The word democracy has been introduced into Vietnam. Is that true that the leadership is using the word democracy? Did I hear that wrong?
It is true, but we need to see the definition of democracy, just like copyright. Yeah, like in your country, when you make a book, I cannot copy. But if you are in my country and then you make something new, I say I can copy it. Why? Because when I look at you, not you individually, but I say, oh, you are just a daughter from my cousin. Why I cannot copy it? Why not? The social bond. So we have a right to copy, not copyright. Yeah. And we feel that is a freedom. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Am I driving you crazy?
Huh? No.
But it was
very dangerous to work with the journalist and writer.
Do you worry? Could you get in some sort of trouble?
If you use wrongly, yes.
That's hard for us to understand, because in our country, everybody's always talking all the time about everything, everywhere.
That's American.
You're more careful?
Yes. The history teaches us to be careful. Individually, nationally. Yeah.
When I returned home from Vietnam, I got a letter from Cong. He writes in part, I can still hear the sound of the kayak pushing the water in Ha Long Bay. Stay in touch. Each tourist is the open door for me to the world outside. Keep open. Your friend in Vietnam, Cong. You go on your left hard. Hard on your left.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our editorial roundtable on the parole of convicted child abuser Gerald Amerald and the role of the press in his incarceration.
Also, two new films, Elephant and Zero Day, are inspired by the Columbine school shootings. How well do they do?
There will be a series of missions followed by a final big-ass mission called Zero Day!
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. It's been another bloody day in Iraq. 2 U.S. soldiers were killed and 4 wounded today in a mortar attack on their base north of Baghdad. Another American died in a shootout in the northern city of Mosul. There's also word of soldiers being wounded in other areas. Witnesses say several troops were wounded in a roadside bomb attack in Fallujah today, the 6th attack against U.S. forces there in as many days. And 13 U.S. soldiers were injured last night in a mortar attack near Bakuba, 40 miles northeast of Baghdad. Donor nations meeting in Spain are pledging money to help rebuild Iraq, but donations are falling far short of what's needed. With the U.S. providing $20 billion, it's estimated another $36 billion is needed from other nations. With the conference half over, pledges are adding up to about $19 billion. Italy was among the first to announce a gift today, $230 million. President Bush is back at home following a six-nation 10-day trip to the Far East and Australia. He capped it off with a fundraiser for his re-election campaign last night at a stopover in Hawaii.
If I seem a little jet-lagged, it's because I've spent a long week away from home. After 8 days on the road and more than 18,000 miles in the air, it's great to be back in America.
He proclaimed progress in a broad agenda, including trade and the war on terror. The era of supersonic commercial air travel has ended. Warren Levinson reports from New York.
A knot of British Airways employees clambered onto the roof of the terminal to see Flight 002, the last of the Concordes, soar into a New York sunrise on its final 3-hour, 20-minute flight to London. "Goodbye, sweet bird," one of them called out as the aircraft rose off the runway. The needle-nosed jet carried an invited crowd that included Christie Brinkley and Joan Collins. British Airways Chairman Colin Marshall called it a happy and sad occasion, marking both the achievement of supersonic passenger service and its end. But for airport neighbors, it was mostly happy. They held an early morning party to celebrate the end of the sonic booms overhead. Warren Levinson at Kennedy Airport, New York.
On Wall Street at midday, stocks are down. The Dow is off 68 points at 95.44. The Nasdaq is down 28 points at 18.56. The S&P 500 is down 10 points at 10.23. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The case that's been called a modern-day Salem witch hunt by disbelievers and the country's most shocking case of child abuse by believers is once again in the news. Last week, the Massachusetts Parole Board voted unanimously to set convicted child abuser Gerald Tukey Amaralt free, 17 years after he was sent to prison for abusing children at his family's Fells Acres Daycare Center. His mother and sister both also spent time in prison and were ultimately released. A vote to commute Gerald's sentence 2 years ago was overturned by then-Governor Jane Swift and garnered huge media coverage. Last Friday's unanimous vote by the parole board was somewhat muted, perhaps overshadowed by the Red Sox loss to the Yankees, or is the press just tired of the story? Joining us on this week's editorial roundtable is one of the Amaralt's greatest defenders, Dorothy Rabinowitz, columnist and editorial board member at The Wall Street Journal. She's long said the Amaralts were swept up in a wave of daycare child abuse cases in the 80s. Welcome, Dorothy.
Thanks very much.
Also joining us is our regular Bill Nemitz, columnist with the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
And back to you, Dorothy. Your reaction to the parole vote?
Well, it was expected because the toughest parole board in the country, they distinguished themselves and the original vote by signing, which has never happened, an unusual statement saying that The case itself was questionable. This does not normally happen. They cast enormous doubt on the entire case.
Well, Dorothy and Bill, let's remind our listeners, this case began when one parent called and said her 5-year-old had been abused. The police then gathered all the parents at the police station, told them to go home and ask their children about charges of a secret room and other charges. And now some experts are saying that the kids could have had those thoughts planted in their minds. But as you well know, Bill, there are doctors, there are victims, there are parents who absolutely believe that Gerald Amrault is a dangerous person.
Well, there's no question that these are different times. I mean, the whole issues of recovered memory and in this case, not even recovered memory, but the power of suggestion have gone through a number of changes, I think, over the past 17 years. I think there was that kind of overwhelming feeling that no matter what the kids say, we have to believe them. And if they say a little, we have to get a lot more. And I think that's where some of these cases got into trouble was in the, I guess what we would call the investigative stage. The question is, was it a true investigation? And would those things be carried out the same way today? I don't think so.
Well, Dorothy, let's concentrate on the press coverage of it. Did the press fail in this story?
It did. I don't think anybody who covered that story would deny that today, because the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald, which led the investigation, then treated Gerald Amrault instantly and immediately, and don't forget, his mother and sister as monsters. When I first wrote about this, I first wrote about the story in 1995. They'd been all been in prison many years and would still be there, I have to say. But to their great credit, the Boston Globe, they did their own excellent investigation.
Well, but what should happen now, Bill? I mean, as I said, there are people who still think that Gerald Amrault, who is scheduled to be released in April, is guilty as sin. Should he be left alone by the press?
Well, there's always going to be interest in what this guy's been through. So I don't think you can just make pretend he doesn't exist. If what you're saying is should he be followed for the rest of his life by 3 satellite trucks and 8 people with notebooks, I don't think so. And frankly, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that once he's out, I think this thing will run out of steam.
I think you're right.
But Dorothy, what about you? I mean, you've been such an advocate. You've written a book about cases like this. Do you lose some of your journalistic edge when someone might say of you in a future case, oh, that she just doesn't believe there are any child abuse cases?
Well, I mean, they can say that, but, you know, they can say that there are little spacemen who've come to steal my eggs and implant them on the moon. I mean, one has to have great trust in the good sense of the public. And this is the important thing I took from this. The large public presented with the facts understood immediately the great journalistic thing, something is wrong with the story, which is an alertness every journalist should have. When something is wrong with the story, something should tell you that in the back of your neck. And once they had the facts, they were utterly prepared to say something is wrong with this case. And the rest of them are deep-dyed believers, and you do not change those people.
Yeah. You know, this touches on a two-track approach to covering these things. One is you have to cover the process. I mean, if there's a press conference, you have to be there if the prosecutor's going to call a press conference. On the other hand, I think a real test of journalistic responsibility then becomes, to what extent are you willing to commit the resources to embark on your own and start looking under these rocks and start reexamining these statements? And as Dorothy says, conduct your own investigation.
Well, and Dorothy, as you well know, many journalists are a little wary of not believing a child who says he or she was abused, even though some of the stories were fantastical and didn't make any sense. I know that I'm going to hear from several of the very respected doctors in this case as soon as we're finished who still believe that he was guilty. And that's tough.
But you know, they have a deep, deep investment in this. And, you know, they held a hearing about Gerald Amrault. A judge held an inquiry. They played some of the tapes of the children being interrogated. And the same journalist who had said he was guilty said, oh, my God, did you hear what this child said? Journalists are capable of changing their minds. Give them the evidence, they will make up their minds. And that's essentially what happened.
Well, we'll have to wait till April to see how the reportage plays out then.
That's right.
But I really don't think it was because of the Red Sox loss that that they brought this news out.
Wait until Boston's in a state of shock, right?
Right. But, Dorothy, I heard that you were going to bring up baseball no matter what here. What?
Oh, how, she's from New York. How can she help it?
No. Thank you, Bill. Well, the truth is we said we had a horrendous night last night, but I have to tell you. I have to tell you that the really important thing was beating the Red Sox. And,
rubbing it in.
I'm sorry to say, but, you know, the other thing is, I mean, talk about media coverage. One of the most extraordinarily undercovered stories of our time being this last month, was the fact that the New York Times, the home paper of the Yankees, endorsed and called for and asked for Boston Red Sox.
Oh, no, we covered that right here at great length.
I mean, this, if this isn't twisted affirmative action, Carrie, I don't know what.
Well, Dorothy, thanks so much for your visit from New York. And, Bill, you know, all we have to say is go Marlins.
That's right. Hey, you know, the only good thing about watching the game last night was, I'll tell you, as a lifelong Red Sox fan, it did cross my mind. I thought, wow, these Marlins are good. At least maybe we got it over early this year.
Well, Bill, I have to say I had that thought, too. I mean, these Marlins are good.
Yeah. Well, Dorothy, you're forgiven for being a Yankees fan, and thanks so much again for joining us.
All right.
Dorothy Rabinowitz, editorial board member of the Wall Street Journal and author of No Crueler Tyrannies, Accusation, False Witness, and Other Terrors of Our Times, and Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press Herald and Maine, members of our editorial roundtable.
Still to come, we review two new movies inspired by the massacre at Columbine High School in Colorado.
You're listening to Here and Now. People are still trying to understand what happened at Columbine High School on April 20th, 1999. Following the horrific shootings, a task force made up of media members, government officials, and parents from Littleton, Colorado, was created by the Attorney General to examine and make accessible the evidence compiled throughout the Columbine investigation. They carried out part of that mission this Wednesday, releasing a videotape portraying Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris firing off different weapons in the forest 6 weeks before that attack on Columbine. Joining us on the line now is Randy Brown. He's a member of the task force. Randy, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Randy, remind us of your unique relationship to this story.
Well, we've been involved from the beginning. My family was the one threatened by Eric Harris on his website a year before Columbine. We took that to the police. My son was then accused as being a participant, and he was later cleared of that. And we've just been involved in many ways since then.
And you had two children in the school. Thankfully, they both escaped, including your son, who was let go by the killers outside of the school. A lot of people remember that. Well, what was your reaction to seeing Klebold and Harris on tape?
Well, it's very interesting. It raises some basic questions. The tape itself doesn't have great investigative value, but what it raises are the questions of what is missing, what we haven't seen. They have been withholding thousands and thousands of investigative pages and at least a dozen other videos that should be seen by the public and by experts.
What do you think they might learn? Because those who've seen it, it's pretty chilling. They're both shooting with sawed-off rifles at bowling pins and at trees.
Well, I think you can learn what the attitude of these boys was, and this is one step in their process toward becoming more violent. They had violent video games, they had violent videos, and then they started shooting weapons and getting weapons to retaliate against the bullies at Columbine. So this is just one aspect of the process they went through, and I think there's a lot to be learned from that.
Are you curious as well, I'm wondering, as to who might have seen this tape and who might have known about this before?
That is the best question there is. This tape was made 6 weeks before Columbine. Other videotapes that were made at the school were seen by kids at the school. We would like to know if this was seen by the video teacher, Mr. Tolacco or Mr. Long. Did they see this tape? Did the police see this tape? Did the school show it to the parents? And if so, why didn't someone follow up on these red flags and do something about this? Is it another red flag that was missed?
I know that one of your other frustrations is that the school and a lot of the conversations between the investigators and the parents, those are part of the papers that haven't been released.
The only statement by the Harrises that exists. As an example, are two depositions they gave, one for the Solvay case and one for a suit the families brought against them. And the judge ordered those to be destroyed immediately upon the settlement of the second case. And many people were upset that the judge would order the destruction of those documents that we believe, again, can help stop another Columbine.
Yeah. Randy, what do you say to people who say, you know what, this was a horrendous thing that happened, but it's over. Let sleeping dogs lie, so to speak.
I would love to. Unfortunately, bullying still exists in our schools, and children are still in danger in our schools, whether people want to believe it or not, whether they want to acknowledge that or not. Hiding your head in the sand won't take care of the problems.
And there are tapes that still exist, the so-called basement videotapes that the two boys made, again, before the killings. Do you think they should be released as well?
No, absolutely. I believe that everything should be released so that experts in this type of violence can study these and can learn what the causes were for this, what the motivating factors were. There are valuable lessons to be learned here, but you can't learn the lessons if you don't know what they are.
Randy Brown, thank you.
Thank you.
Randy Brown is a parent and member of the Columbine Task Force.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
On April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold took explosives and semi-assault weapons to Columbine High School and killed 12 fellow students, a teacher, and themselves. Everywhere in the United States and around the world, for that matter, people shook their heads and asked questions with no real answers. Why? How could this have happened? What went wrong? Now, more than 4 years later, Hollywood's posing the same questions in two new films, remarkable for the naturalism they attempt to create, and because neither movie much goes in for answers. Elephant is by director Gus Van Sant, and Zero Day is director Ben Coccio's first film. Both films appear in gradual release in the coming weeks, and joining us to give his take on them is Garen Daly, film reviewer for the WBUR show On Point. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Bill.
Garen, briefly recap both films for us. What are they about?
Well, both films take the Columbine Massacre as a jumping-off point. Elephant, which is the Gus Van Sant film, which won the Cannes Festival Palme d'Or, as well as Best Director for Van Sant, he takes a very kind of personal point of view camera. He walks the cameras around the high school behind and in front of the students so you get a sense of what's going on leading up to the tragedy. So it's more about the high school life. In Zero Day, Coccio, he does a Blair Witch Project sort of thing where it's very much of the camera of the two participants, the two killers, and they're taking the camera and turning it onto themselves, where they look at themselves, they talk to themselves, and they explain their motivations and what they're doing as they go along. So one is more of a distant view, and one is a more personal view.
And yet both, that kind of naturalistic filmmaking you're talking about and we're talking about, why do you think that Columbine seemed to inspire directors wanting a near documentary feel in what they did?
Well, I think the problem is that as a society and as a culture, we haven't really dealt with the root causes of what caused these two young suburban, supposedly everything they had was wonderful guys, to have them go out and kill a dozen or so people. It's almost too much for us to comprehend. So they needed a new structure, a new way of looking at it to be able to begin that approach, to begin the conversation or the dialogue on it. For instance, in the beginning of Zero Day, the two protagonists actually do something very similar to what happens in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And in this clip that we're going to hear, you're going to hear them talking about them getting set up to go after their high school.
My name is Andre Kriegman.
And I am Cal Gabriel.
And we are the Army of Two.
This is our high school, located in our town. It is our worst enemy.
It is our nemesis.
There will be a series of missions followed by a final big-ass mission called Zero Day!
This is like a whoa, dude approach, and these guys in the movie are killers.
They're going to be killers. And this says everything that Katya wants to say about how society has shaped these young men versus Van Zandt, who has his protagonist kind of scoping out the cafeteria and drawing plans and being very much a disaffected youth. Because one of the things with Van Zandt, and you take a close look at his films, most of his youths are somehow disaffected, disassociated. They're outside the mainstream. Even Good Will Hunting, it's an Oscar-winning film. The Matt Damon character is someone struggling for acceptance within society. Mm. So with the guys that he has in Elephant, the same thing is going on. And just a little, here's a little taste of what we're talking about. The guy is in the cafeteria, and he's drawing plans, and another student walks up to him and asks him, what's he doing?
Where are you writing?
Oh, this?
Yeah.
It's my plan.
For what?
Oh, yes, sir.
See, that's very quick, very thing, but he's doing it really nicely. He's setting up. Well, the audience knows what's going to be happening because we know what's going to happen at the end.
Now, the key question here has got to be in either film, whether you believe these characters would be capable of doing what they did or whether it gets to be a little tinny, a little phony. Do you believe it?
Well, so both directors are successful in getting us to get involved in that universe, and you do accept it. Whether or not you understand what the motivation is behind them, that's a whole other story because they don't really give us the answers that we want. It's not a cut and dried and something that we can grab a hold of.
And yet, you know, you read deeply into the Columbine case. You don't come away with answers as to why those two guys did what they did.
Well, I think that's why these two filmmakers are bringing these films right out right now. The conversation in our society is now beginning. And one of the things that Van Zandt does very, very well is he creates the student. You feel like you're the student inside the high school. You can actually feel yourself back in the high school setting. The sounds are very natural. The bells are ringing in the background. The sound is not muted by some sort of sound booth. And in the scene that we're going to listen to next, two of the students in this high school, in Elephant, are Eli and John. They're two nice guys, and they meet in the hall like anybody else would meet in the hall.
Hey, Eli.
Hey, what's up, John?
How's it going?
Good. What are you doing?
Just taking pictures. Okay. Can I take a picture of you?
Yeah, sure.
Nice.
All right, hey, I'll see you later.
Yeah.
Hey, you going to the concert tonight?
No, I can't. My parents are being bitches this week.
Oh, that's retarded.
Yeah.
That happens.
All right, I'll see you.
Now, what you don't know, because you just heard the clip, is that scene is played out three times by three different protagonists, one by Eli, one by John, who we just heard, and another by a young woman named Michelle, who is going to end up being a victim in the film, running down the hallway. And that scene where he talks about the parents. And that's an important part, too, because where are the parents in all of this? And it's very interesting to know that in Zero Day, you get to meet the parents, and in Elephant, all you get to do is see the bodies of the parents. You never see their heads. You're disassociated with the parents. So both filmmakers are saying a little bit something different about the role of parents in these two youth lives.
The parents in Zero Day are actually the parents of the actors, right?
That is correct. One of the nice things about both of these films is that they've used unknown actors or absolutely people who were not actors. In Elephant, most of the people there were students who integrated all their own characteristics that they had in high school into their own roles.
And that much naturalism, Garen, doesn't get awkward. Sometimes when they're non-actors, it's too obvious that they're non-actors. They're trying to act, but they're not very good at it, so it doesn't work.
There's a fair amount of naturalism here that actually works. I think the problem that most viewers are going to have is that it's not as accessible as a straight-ahead narrative drama. It is not as accessible as, say, an even after-school special about this. So there's going to be a little bit of a learning curve that you have to go and a little bit of suspending what you would normally expect to be able to enjoy the film as much as you would want to.
Garen, this is grim stuff. I mean, you go to see Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill. It's violent, but arguably entertaining. Why would anyone want to go see films about massacres at high school? It's such a dark subject.
It is a dark subject, and it's not an entertaining subject like Kill Bill is or some of these ultra-violent films. But I think that what we may want to look at these films for is that if we are a society that lives off the Kill Bills and these ultra-violences, this, what there's being depicted in these films, may be the partial outcome of that. And in that, it is worthwhile for us to see, not so much to be entertained, but to be challenged intellectually and perhaps emotionally. And especially when you hear some of the dialogue scenes, like in Zero Day, there's a scene where the young boy is sitting playing a sitar, explaining himself.
It occurs to me that a lot of people are probably going to wonder, like, how could somebody do something like Zero Day, like what we're going to do? But I want to know is, how many kids want to kill themselves and do? You know, thousands of kids do this. But how many of them realize that the way of the samurai is found in death? I'm not going to leave cleanly. I'm not just going to fade out. I'm going to make my mark, and then it'll be my time to die. I mean, it's a lost cause when you just kill yourself, you know.
Disturbing stuff.
It is disturbing.
Garen, are people going to go see these movies? These are not going to be big hits.
They're not going to be big hits, but I would recommend that you go see them because, again, they are challenging and they do begin the conversation, which I think we definitely need to do. These two boys at Columbine did kill some people, and it's going to happen again, and we need to understand what is going on with these young boys.
Thank you, Garen Daly, for our conversation.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly covers film for WBUR's On Point. We were looking at the films Zero Day and Elephant. Elephant opens in New York and Los Angeles today and nationwide November 7th. Zero Day is playing in selected cities around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cridell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis, Brad Fritz and Jordana Gustafson. Ed Walters and Ann Stevenson are interns. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry and Tim Skog. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
The leader of Botswana proposes denying medical care to those who refuse to get tested for AIDS first.
Also, Roberta Flack on the origin of Killing Me Softly and how she nurtures young artists.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.